Hello, and welcome to Cardigcast, a glam podcast brought to you by New Cardigan. If you'd like to become a member of New Cardigan, head to our website at newcardigan.org. And if you're able to do so, please consider making a donation after you've joined, or maybe even buy a t-shirt. We're run entirely by volunteers, so anything that you can do helps us keep the servers whirring and the Cardies partying. Our October Cardi Party in Melbourne is at the Percy Granger Museum. Client Services Officer Tamara Jones takes us for a tour throughout the museum and discusses Percy Granger himself. Chelsea Harris also participates by discussing the Curate Your Career project, which is partnered with the University of Melbourne.
I would also like to introduce Tamara Jones and Chelsea Harris. Sorry, Chelsea, there you are. And Chantelle Mitchell, who is there. There you go, from the Granger Museum. And thank all of you for today. I'm going to hand over to Tamara now so I'll stop talking and allow Tamara to tell you a little bit about Percy Granger and this collection.
Yes, and the museum.
Yes.
Bit of everything. I too wanted to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this event is taking place, the land of the Wurundjeri, and pay respect to their elders and families. Thank you so much for coming to the Granger tonight. We were really excited to have you all, and thank you to New Cardigan for letting us hold this event. This event's actually been in the works for about a year now, so it's really exciting you now all here. Just a little bit of quick housekeeping. I haven't organised a disaster, but if there is an emergency, we can exit through the front and we can exit through the back courtyard at the back. We have a lot to cover tonight, and we're going to barely scratch the surface of this museum and Percy Granger. I really encourage you to come back because there's a lot you can learn. I'm going to talk about the museum and Percy Granger, and then I'm going to hand over to Chelsea, who will talk about the Curate Your Career program, and then it's going to come back to me, and I'm going to talk about my favourite part of this collection. Oh, and then you get a chance to wander around. But let's begin. What do people know about Percy Granger? Just shout things out. Yes?
Very handsome devil.
Oh, I'm not going to say yes or no, but yes, handsome devil.
Musician, best man.
Yes. Anybody else?
Is he a composer?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So he was many things, but he was notably Australia's first world-renowned composer, a world-renowned composer and arranger of music, and I've lost my train of thought, a concert pianist of international standing. So he was born on the 2nd of July, 1882. In Brighton, Melbourne, so he was a local boy, but he died on February the 20th, 1961 in White Plains, New York. He was a very busy man, so from his first public performance, which was at the Melbourne Masonic Hall at the age of 12, to his last performance in 1960, he performed over 3,000 times, which, just to put that in a little bit of perspective, that works out to 40 concerts a year, and if you think that he started when he was 12, and that's a very, very busy schedule. I'd never heard of Percy Granger before I came to this museum, and it took me a while to, I suppose, understand the concept, but he was considered a megastar of the European, North American, Australian stage. Just as an example of his popularity, when he got married, which was at the Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles, 15,000 to 23,000 people attended.
Oh.
Yes, so 15,000 to 23,000 people attended the wedding, which, naturally was at the end of a concert. And he was so popular and he was receiving so much fan mail that he had a general letter to fans written up. So he didn't have to individually write my thank you for your letter. He performed all over the world, but his first public performance was in America in January 1915. 1 month later, his New York debut was completely sold out. And mentioning Country Gardens, that broke its publisher's sales records for 75 consecutive years. So he was a megastar at the time. There was also more to Percy Granger than his musical accomplishments. His performance behaviour is considered quite eccentric, so sometimes at the beginning of a performance, he'd leap onto stage, or he'd be in the middle of the performance, and he'd just stop, he'd chat to the audience, and then start up again. He was really into healthy living, so he didn't drink, he didn't smoke, and he was a vegetarian. But when I say he was a vegetarian, he didn't like meat because he didn't like vegetables either. work that one out. He was an inventor. So in our permanent collection, we have a crude forerunner to the modern sports bra that he invented for one of, or he designed for one of his girlfriends. And he'd also collect rubbish and turn it into musical contraptions. He was a sadomasochist. So if you're not sure, he took pleasure in inflicting pain, having pain inflicted on him. And like many things in his life, this was really well documented. If you're interested, there's a section up the back which looks at this, and he wanted it labelled the Lust Branch, so that is the Lust Branch of the museum. Another very interesting thing was he was really into toweling, and he would create clothes out of this. I believe his first love was Turkish towels, but then he developed a love for Australian towels. And this wasn't clothing that you'd only wear in private. No, he wore these out in public. And he considered them warm in winter, cool in summer, and machine washable. So if you want, you know, to reinvent your wardrobe, think of the towels. Now, not long after his mother's death in 1922, he started thinking about, like, a museum. Now, he lived most of his life overseas, but he was really adamant that a museum be built in Australia. And he contacted the University of Melbourne in 1935 to ask permission to build a museum on university land. This was granted, and the museum was designed with close consultation with Granger, but also by the university architect. This building was built in 1935, and it was opened in 1938. And we'll be celebrating our 80th birthday this year, so, you know, happy birthday to us. Apparently, on the original plans, this was meant to be a two-story building, but this was quickly was a one-story building, and I believe there was meant to be a staircase just outside the door there. Mm-hmm. But no two-story, no need for staircase. The Granger Museum is the only purpose-built autobiographical museum in Australia, and we hold in excess 100,000 items. So Granger was a really avid collector. Some might call him a bit of a hoarder, but he really wanted you to see what influenced him. He wanted you to see the table he ate at, the clothes he wore, the letters he wrote. And consequently, our collection ranges from performance programs to back hair. And I feel the need to say that again. There is back hair in this collection. Ticket stubs, shopping lists, furniture. There's a little bit of everything, and like, not, you know, to give our museum another plug, but you should really come back and actually have a look at all the displays, because there'll be some very surprising things in there. This museum is open Sunday to Friday from 12 to 4. Another easier way to say it is we're not open Saturday, and admission is free. That side of the museum is our permanent collection, and this side of the museum is our temporary exhibitions, and we now currently have Objects of Fame, which is really new, and I definitely go have a look. There is an amazing cake down there, so it's definitely worth a gander at. Already this year, we've had over 7,000 visitors, and our visitors range from local visitors, school groups, to international tourists. Some are Percy Granger fans, some want to see the towel and clothing, and why wouldn't you want to? And quite a few just walk past this building and they say, you know, what's inside? You probably can see that there's a school just across the road. And myself, I've been working here, and you quite often get parents that come in and they're like, I've been dropping my kid off at the school for years, I've always wondered what's in here, I've got 5 minutes, what can you tell me? Like, have you heard about Percy Granger? We don't just cater to visitors, we also have several different programs. We offer collaborative learning for our students at university. We have a very successful volunteer program. Like our visitors, our volunteers come from like all different interests and walks of life. And some, well, a lot of them are current or past University of Melbourne students, which one of the volunteers are, for example, actually used to study here, which is really interesting because I might say, you know, this room was used for such and such, but he's like, I studied here, that's in the wrong place. I'm now going to pass over to Chelsea to talk about the Create Your Career program. So,
thanks, Tamar. I might stay here if people can see me and hear me. I'd also like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people their elders past, present and emerging. And just as a quick intro, I work for with Tamara at the Granger Museum and Special Collections, which is the name of our broader department. I market or promote the exhibitions both at the Granger Museum and the North Shore Gallery in the Bailey Library. I don't know if anyone's been to the North Shore Gallery? Yes. So we have four sort of temporary exhibitions every year, two in each space. So my role is to basically build audiences. It's to promote the exhibitions, run the public programs, exhibition openings, and I always have an intern every semester to help with the work that I do. So just a bit of background to me. I study the Master of Art Curatorship here at the university. I have a background in, I have an arts degree as my undergraduate. So my primary interests are audience engagement and building vocational experiences for young people. So prior to my role at the Granger, I've only been here for 3 years. I ran a project at the Ian Potter Museum, if people know the university's art museum. So that was essentially giving the Faculty of Arts postgraduate students experience in delivering public programming. So the idea was that they would create floor talks, film screenings, social media competitions, various other programs, and try and basically market it to their peers and get other students along to events. But today I'll be speaking about Curate Your Career, so it's my current project. I've got postcards here for people if they're interested. So essentially the project stemmed from what I saw as a lack of diversity in the GLAM sector. So I'm sure it's the same as in libraries, there's probably a lot of librarians here, but in museums and galleries, I go to a lot of seminars and conferences and I see a lot of women in particular who look like me. There aren't many Indigenous staff members, for example, in museums and galleries across Melbourne and in other parts of Australia. So I thought, you know, I looked at the sort of professional development opportunities, the mentoring opportunities and the schemes that are available to try and change this situation. And I came across a grant scheme at the university. So it's run through the university's chancellery office, so it's the sort of strategic arm of the university. And it's called an Equity Innovation Grant. So it's the purpose of it, it actually stems from federal government funding. So the idea is to the retention and success of low SES students. So the university's domestic equity program is called Access Melbourne. And Access Melbourne students can be eligible for a range of reasons. So they can be from an underrepresented school, from a low SES background, identify as Indigenous Australian, have English as a second language, come from rural or regional Victoria, amongst other factors. So students with perceived barriers to study. So the aim of the project was essentially to, because I'm familiar with programming, my experience is programming events, particularly for young people, we always try to get as many students to our public programs as possible. People work with student audiences for events, you know that it's very difficult to do. So yeah, we run, actually with our exhibition public programs, we run evaluation on every event. So we actually look at the student demographic and we can see the numbers, you know, the events that attract more students than others. So for example, with exhibition public programs, we know that students like curators' floor talks and they like participatory events such as workshops. So we ran a very successful print making workshop, a writing workshop. But I wanted the, so Curate Your Career is centred on four events. So they were themed forums scheduled in semester two. So I've just had the last of the forums in early October. Chantelle here helped with the first forum, which was really great. And my intern, Daniela, helped with the other three. So the themes of the four forums were skills expected of current graduates, new and emerging jobs in the sector, internships, volunteering and other opportunities, and networking. So it was interesting to see the bookings for each event. Networking had the least amount of bookings because I think people see it can be perceived as an aggressive term. But so the students were very interested in the internships and volunteering forum, and I had the most bookings for that one. So the idea was to bring two professionals from the sector for each of the four forums, so to have engage them in a sort of in conversation style event. So I was the Tony Jones 2.0 in conversation with the professionals who came from, as you'd expect, some of the major cultural institutions across Melbourne, ACME, the NGV, Melbourne Museum. I was very keen to have a professional from a regional museum or gallery, because I think they can often be left out of these sorts of opportunities. So I had a wonderful woman, Faiza Yazar, from the Shepherd and Art Museum. Yes, if people know Faiza, very distinctive name. So the idea was that we would use the themed topics to, you know, delve into certain questions that I posed the fellow professionals, and then would always have a talk of career pathways. So I think that with the glam sector, and maybe more particularly for galleries and museums, there's no one linear pathway into the sector. There's many different ways that you can enter, and surprising ways. So we had some really great discussions. I purposely chose my presenters with certain criteria. So they were all Gen X and Gen Y. I think they were all actually maybe under 40, or, you know, low 40s and below, because I thought those are the people who have been more mobile in the sector more recently. So they've been more recently applying for jobs. They're less likely to perhaps to have been in a role in an institution for a long time, as some of our older colleagues have been. And I wanted to have about half of my professionals be Indigenous professionals, with the thinking that targeting Indigenous students, that would inspire the students that they could go on to careers in the sector, and also to have professionals from a variety of roles. So I had a conservator, I had someone in public programs, I actually had quite a few curators, and all my curators were First Nations curators. So all the Indigenous professionals that I found were in curatorial roles. It was harder for me to find them in conservation or marketing, just through, you know, it is quite hard to find out that information, but I did through networks. And yeah, so there was a diverse mix of voices that were represented, which is what I really strove for. And so the idea was that the students would have access to these professional contacts and their practical insights, and then there could be a follow through. So many of the presenters provided their email addresses, so the students could then follow up and have those contacts and have the sort of social networks and people they could call to inquire about positions or internships or other opportunities within those organisations. So for our department, I mean, for the students, there are a number of outcomes that I wanted. So, you know, knowledge of the transferable skills required for mobility in the sector, understanding of the ways to access opportunities, volunteering, internships, grants and residencies, insight into the new and emerging positions in the sector. And we looked at sort of new positions in communications, in programming for unique audiences and culturally diverse audiences. For our department, we can make connections with colleagues across the organisation in equity programming, and we would have the event evaluation data. So I did a survey for each of the four forums to enable the department to better meet the needs of student audiences. And I also made sure to have representatives from some of the museums and galleries across the campus. So I had a colleague from Buxton Contemporary down at the VCA, if people have been to it, and from the Ian Potter Museum of Art. So this is very much a pilot program on a small scale. So I am writing up the evaluation report currently, which will be complete by the end of November. And based on the findings, I do feel like the work can fill a need, but I would like to broaden it out beyond this university and actually broaden it to sort of focus it, in a sense, just on Indigenous students, but at universities across Melbourne. So look at RMIT, Swinburne, Monash. So if you're at any of these organisations and you've got ideas, please come up to me afterwards, because I'd love to chat about how to evolve the project. But I'm looking at some funding schemes, such as the McCoy funding scheme, the partnership with Museums Victoria, and partnering with someone in Bundjalaka to sort of run that programming for that pool of Indigenous students, that cohort, and trying to support their entry into the sector. When we know that the numbers are very minute of Indigenous staff working at those institutions. So that's probably it for me, and I'm happy to answer questions now or later. Feel free to speak to me later. I'll be around while you're working away throughout the museum. So it's really, I'm at the point where I'm really happy to brainstorm ideas with people and to think how the project can sort of fill a gap or serve a need that exists, that, yeah, from my research I see that there's still a lot of work to be done in this area. So
please, let's thank Josie for looking at it. Okay, so I'm going to now talk about my favourite bit of the collection. As you heard, there's a lot I could have talked about. Thought about the back hair, but I thought maybe not. But I'm going to talk about his folk music collecting. Probably what I'm most knowledgeable about. It's what I find the most interesting. And I was also really keen to show you something that's, I consider it quite special. You've taken time out of your Friday, and I wanted to give you something that you left with and was like, yeah, this was like good. I'm going to play a short 30-second clip. Unfortunately, it comes out of the speakers in the computer over here, so if you can't hear, you might have to come across, but I've made it as loud as I can. So that track is titled Brig Fair, and it was sung by an English folk singer called Joseph Taylor in Brig, Lincolnshire, England. Clearly that was a digital recording, but does anyone want to take a guess when the original was recorded? And again, anything... Right now, yeah. 19. Oh, too good. No. No, very good. That was recorded in 1908. So we just listened to a recording that is about 110 years old. So Percy Grainger, alongside being a composer and arranger of music, was also a collector of folk music. He was first introduced to folk music while he was in Germany, but it was when he was in England that he developed an interest. And his British legacy is actually considered a revival in the interest of folk music. He recorded folk singers in England, Denmark, and New Zealand, the Pacific Islands, and numerous Grainger compositions are actually inspired by folk music. He was also one of the first to use a phonograph in 1906 to record the singers, and he assembled over 200 Edison Roll recordings, and these range from English to Danish to Maori. These records were later transferred onto acetate disc by the Library of Congress in America in the 1940s, and the Grainger Museum digitized their copies in the early 2000s. We're now going to take a walk, so it's a good chance to like move around a little bit. So please follow me. Just as a side note, so this area of the museum looks at his early life. So being born in Melbourne, his study in Germany and England. As you can tell, most of the displays are modern creations, but some of them were actually created by Percy Grainger, such as these ones, which I thought was pretty interesting, you might want to see. So leaving here, we go into this gallery. This looks at his experiences during World War I. He didn't serve overseas, but he did enlist. And It also looks at the death of his mother and meeting and marrying his wife. But this is what I wanted to bring us all into. I'm afraid we're going to have to squish around a little bit.
There's some more toweling over there if you'd...
It's very attractive.
All right, so this area looks at his interests and his hobbies, but I brought you here specifically because if you come back to the museum, which I really hope you do, this looks at his folk music collecting. And also, if you weren't sure, this is a phonograph, and I also believe it's the actual phonograph he used to record the singers. And if you weren't sure what an Edison roll is either, because I had no idea, that's them down there. So I've listened to a lot of these recordings, and they're really incredible for so many different ways. I find it quite amazing that in 2018, you're listening to someone singing a song in 1908. But it was only when I was thinking about this talk and I read some of the notations, I actually cottoned on that a lot of the folk singers were older gentlemen, and they, when they were recounting the song, were actually recounting a song that they learnt when they were a lot younger. So you're not just listening in 2018 to someone singing a song in 1906, you're actually listening to somebody recounting a song that they heard. Some of the singers might have been about 60 to 80 years old, and they said that they learnt these songs when they were 11. So it's almost like reaching back through history and like picking this point in time and saying, this is what I heard. There are also live recordings. So occasionally the singer will make a mistake and they'll grumble or they might laugh, which given, you know, we're used to clean music, it's really bizarre to hear someone just like be like, oh, grumble. And they'd also occasionally talk to the recorder, who was generally Percy Grainger. And even that's really interesting because you can't hear what they're saying, but it's like you're listening into this private conversation. And I can't help wondering, like, what are they talking about? Like, what's happening around them? Why didn't they just, like, lean into the microphone a little bit more? This collection also isn't just the digital recordings, they have some rolls. Percy Grainger also took photographs of the singers. He also took down notations of the songs. So you don't just have the title and the notes, but you have the words. What I played you just then was a very good recording. It was actually taken in a studio from one of the folk singers that sung out and about. But yeah, it was very good. Most of them aren't so good. You can barely understand them, but it's really hard to understand what they're saying. But then you have the wording and you can follow along, which is incredibly handy. I kind of want to leave it there mostly because I really want you to come back and have a look at the museum, but have a look at this section. But I also chose the specific area of the collection because our recordings aren't available to the public. So if you hadn't come tonight, you wouldn't have heard what I just played. And I also think this collection is really multifaceted, like this museum and like Percy Grainger. So not only does the collection, it has Edison rolls and digital recordings and music, it's also part of a wider collection which has, you know, programs and back hair and shopping lists and things like that. This museum isn't just a museum, it's also a teaching facility and we have an attached archive. And Percy Grainger, he wasn't just a collector, or he wasn't just a composer and arranger of music. He was also a folk music collector. He was a towel and clothing enthusiast. he was a photographer. He was a bit of everything. There's more than meets to the eye to this collection, so I really encourage you to come back. That's actually it for me. Please don't forget to, if you want, I would sign up to our newsletter because there's always something happening at the Grainger Museum, and it's a really good way to keep in touch. Please thank Chelsea and Chantel again for being here tonight and talking. And that's it from me. Does anyone have any questions? I'll try and answer them.
Given that this is a biographical museum based on the collection of Percy Grainger, mm-hmm. do you still actively collect? And if so, do you have criteria for that?
I'm not so sure about criteria, but we definitely do still receive items in. There was a collection, the last exhibition that was up. I was actually walking through and I noticed something that I'd accessioned in recently, which was really cool. So it was like, oh, I know what that is.
And they all have a link to Percy Grainger, or are you looking broad around the themes that he was collecting? So like the folk music, towel and clothing, or does it all have to have a kind of provenance back to him?
Probably not the best person to be asking that question, but generally, yes.
I can touch on that a tiny bit. This
basically, for a while, it feels like the collection, you know, kind of grew. Particularly, you know, I feel like in the middle of last century, we were accessioning a lot of things. But given, you know, the immense amount of material we have in our collection, it's narrowed quite a lot since then. And basically, it has to be very directly relevant to Percy Grainger mm-hmm. now. So we're not so much looking at accessioning things that are aligned with Percy's interests, for example, because he had so many interests. So yeah, it's very kind of tightly kind of connected to Percy. So an object needs to have some kind of personal significance. So,
I just got one more question. Is there a collection store on campus, or whereabouts is the rest of the collection?
Yeah, so it's up in Brunswick. Sorry, I'm not from Melbourne, so I was a bit like, where is it? Yeah, there's a lot of stuff up in Brunswick because this building is, you know, somewhat large, but 100,000 items. You know, some of them are pianos. There's only so much room.
I'm fascinated by the idea of an autobiographical museum that you like build yourself and so on. Obviously, there aren't any in Australia, but are there others around the world that you can, you know, that you.
There's the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford in England. Yeah. That's built around the collection of Pitt Rivers.
Yeah.
And is quite eclectic and very eclectic and very eccentric. Mm. And is attached to university too.
Because I'm from an art history background, I'm familiar with people that like, okay, this is my collection, I'm going to make a museum in my house. But the idea of a museum that documents your own life and your own pursuits, I think, is really, really interesting.
About Germaine Greer's archive. Like, she's already thinking, she's made sure that that's going to be there for posterity. And she was collecting about herself since she's 7 years old, I think. Oh, wow. So there's a lot of people that are a little bit egotistical, you might say. And I hope Germaine Greer's not listening to this podcast. It's pretty doubtful, but
I could be wrong at this, so no, I wish we weren't being recorded, but I have a feeling because there was going to be two levels. It was one level was going to be Percy Grainger, and the top level, or whichever one, was going to look at music in Australia. Mm-hmm. But then the second level wasn't built. So,
Did he actually study at Melbourne University? Why did he choose this site?
Yeah, he always had a link, or he always had an affiliation with Melbourne, and he was just really adamant that it was built here. But he did live most of his life overseas, and he did die in White Plains, New York. And the house where he actually lived is now the Percy Grainger Library, I believe.
In the US.
In the US, yeah.
Thank you so much for listening, and we hope that you have enjoyed this tour of the Percy Grainger Museum. We'd love for you to review us on iTunes. It does help others to find out about CardiCast, and it lets us know that we're on the right track. To keep an ear out for more CardiCasts, either click subscribe or check out our website at newcardigan.org for more events, news and merchandise. And remember, folks, JFDI.